Well, thanks. That was a really good introduction to this conversation.
Yeah.
So, Sunny, from community radio's perspective and being an independent producer and an activist, you know, it'd be great to hear your kind of your experience. How long have you been doing this?
Well, for those of you that don't know what indie media is, it's, you know, during the 1999 Seattle protests against the WTO, you know, a bunch of people came together, a bunch of media activists came together and were like, you know, we already know what this, how this scenario is going to play out. We already know what this coverage is going to be like, and, you know, why don't we do something about it? Why don't we set up our own media organization that will cover, you know, the things that are important to us? So over the period of a couple of months, people rented a space. They, you know, acquired donations of video cameras and audio equipment and cameras and, you know, set up a radio station. They, you know, were able to, you know, print hundreds and hundreds of copies of a preliminary newsletter that they sent out beforehand with the different stories that, you know, different breaking stories about the WTO and research that people had done. And inevitably, what ended up happening was that, yeah, you know, hundreds of thousands of people came to Seattle to protest the WTO, and it was basically, you know, a footnote in the, you know, overall media coverage, not only even locally, but also across the country. And it was horrible. I mean, it was, you know, the police repression was unbelievable, and, you know, the absolute unity of so many different groups coming together on one issue was incredible, and it just wasn't getting any coverage at all. And suddenly, out of nowhere, this website that had served as kind of the base foundation that linking all of these different media projects was getting more hits than CNN and was getting more hits than, you know, any of the other news organizations that were covering anything. And it was to the point where they had to, you know, take out two backup servers just to, you know, supplement the load that was coming in. And people thought, wow, we really have something here. There is a need for an independent perspective, you know, a voice that's saying, yeah, we know that this can be construed as some sort of a biased coverage of something, but that is what we're dealing with, is biased media across the board. And so why not have media that is unfiltered, that is coming directly from the people's mouths, and is also empowering people from the streets to tell their stories without any kind of a corporate domination, you know, lurking over their shoulders. It was a phenomenon. And overnight, indie media was born, and people began to donate money, and Seattle was one of the first. And in 2000, San Francisco was visited by the National Association of Broadcasters, and many people were very upset because at the time, what eventually became the deregulations that the FCC decided to put into effect in 2003 was already kind of fomenting, and people were fed up. And so, you know, again, hundreds and thousands of people came to protest, and San Francisco developed its own indie media center. And since then, we have a radio station. It's called Enemy Combatant Radio. We do live broadcasts 24 hours a day, and we do a show on Access SF, and it's also syndicated in Berkeley and now Marin, and Street Level TV. And we do trainings, we do workshops. We have a new newspaper that has recently just come out. It's called Fault Lines, and it has articles from all over the world on different news stories. And it really is a phenomenon, I think, just in the fact that it's completely volunteer run. The money is basically sustained off of, you know, film screenings that we do, or subscriptions to the newspaper, or donations. And it's just to be able, we've been around, you know, 2000, so, you know, 4 years now, and no one ever thought we would be here. And so it's just, but I think, you know, listening to Lisa, I can relate to a lot of what she's saying, because I think sustainability is definitely a key issue for all forms of independent media. And, you know, burnout is also another key factor. I mean, all of us have day jobs. All of us have work to do. And so the amount of work that it takes to maintain this and to, you know, do all these things for free is pretty demanding.
Could you speak a little bit to the sort of the interesting collective and working group structure that Indie Media has. I think it's really dynamic and probably says a lot about your sustainability model.
Well, Indie Media is, like I said, it's volunteer run, but it's also a collective, which means that we use a form of modified consensus. There's no, part of the mission is that, we see all these things that are wrong with society. We see all the things that we know that don't work for us in everyday life and don't work for us in terms of the kind of media that we consume. But we also don't want to continue perpetuating those things within our own working dynamics. Basically it's we're very aware and cognizant of, the things like sexism and racism that that worm their way into any social project, no matter how progressive, no matter how radical. And so this is something that, we do a lot of active outreach in communities of color and low-income communities. We initially, through Media Alliance, which is one of the sponsors of this conference, did a project with the Street Sheet and Street Spirit in the East Bay. These are newspapers that are completely produced by homeless people. And we would do the training workshops at the Independent Media Center. And this was a way to kind of give media skills to people that really have to pay a large sum of money to get them at a university or wherever, And I think that's one of the projects that we're most proud of, because that really speaks to trying to give access to everybody, no matter what your social status is, or no matter how much money you have. And so really, the consensus model, the modified consensus, basically making sure that we talk through things, making sure that the decisions that we make, the important decisions, are we hold those up against our mission statement. Lisa talked a little bit about editorial policy and how important that is, and that's something that it's a big decision, and people don't always agree. There's a lot of wealthy donors that have tried to give us huge sums of money, and people are always, it's a tough decision.
It's interesting how there's not often much of a difference between a donor and an investor.
Yeah.
there's the nonprofit model and the for-profit model, and a lot of ways don't operate that differently. There's sort of a return on your investment versus a return on your mission. I think it's
right.
So it's like, they're going to back you.
Do we take lots of money from Ford and General Motors, or do we say, no, you're evil, and we don't, we don't want your money? And
you take the money, and then you say
evil. And then you're evil. Yeah. So that's, it's always, there's purists, and then there's, the people that are like, listen, we need to pay rent in our DSL bill this month, so. We need to
stay open, right?
To stay open to those. And that's healthy, and that should continue to happen, because. I think once we stop discussing those things, that's when we really fall into a pattern and a rut where we become very comfortable just, compromising on everything. And I think, discussion is good. So.
And that's when burnout really sets in.
Yeah. And I think, and just in general about independent media, I think that, things like cable access and the work that Lisa's doing and the work that Pete is doing, all of these things really... people do need to think about them in the sense of like a sacrifice. This is what it's going to take to actually maintain control over our forms of communication. That's really what it is our venues of communication. And, they will get taken away from us if we don't. Things like public television are really only survive off of people actually putting in the work to do the shows. Otherwise, if the shows aren't there, then they get bought out by, huge companies. And it's the same thing with independent media, then the work that we do, whether it's on the air or whatever. I also used to DJ at San Francisco Liberation Radio, and that work's still in court right now, trying to, get the FCC to get our money back and get all of our equipment back and hold them accountable. They seized our equipment last year, in June of last year, and under this very archaic maritime law. It's a 100-year-old maritime law, basically giving the government the ability to board the ships of pirates and smugglers to seize their booty. So we weren't in the ocean, but, I don't, so this loophole pirates. Enabled, yeah, we're pirates. So we prefer micro broadcasters. And, and so they were able to do that. They were able to obtain a secret warrant, not go through the judge. And it was a very shady ordeal. We were actually in a dialogue with them at the time to reapply for a license, because we had actually tried to apply for a license twice. But those of you that may be familiar with low power FM know how difficult it is to get a license if you're not, you know, Clear Channel or Viacom nowadays. So, you know, the first time they sent us the application back saying that we didn't fill it out correctly. They didn't say what we didn't fill out correctly, but, you know, we filled it out again, sent it back in, and they just never got back to us. So we kept broadcasting. We're like, well, if you're not going to work with us, then, you know, we're going to do what needs to be done. And that, at the time, you know, when SFLR was founded, the Persian Gulf War was going on, and of course we all know what the coverage of that looked like. You know, there was also a lot of stuff going on locally that, you know, was very disturbing, you know, just the way the coverage was going. And so, you know, that, you know, the thing about SFLR, and I think, like, again, about independent media, is that when it's supported by the community, you're kind of you're in a symbiotic relationship with the community, where you're saying, listen, if I don't uphold my end of the agreement, and if I don't live up to the responsibilities that I'm saying, you know, that I'm pledging to you that I will do, then you have the right to say that you don't want me on the air. You have the right to take, you know, say that you don't want my show on TV. And I think that's important, you know. And that was always part of our mission statement, that you know, if we ever, it's not just a right. It's not just take back our airwaves. It's my airwaves, and I want them. You know, it's a responsibility too, and it's a privilege. And so, I think we always tried to be very cognizant of that fact. And hopefully, the judge just threw out the injunction. We had filed for an injunction, and she actually gave it a week to think about. And she was like, you know, there is something wrong with this. There is something wrong with this case, and I'm going to have to think about it. But she came back and ruled in favor of the FCC. And so now she has expressed to us that she's very interested in moving to the next level, where we would file for a First Amendment violation, a violation of our right to basically be on the air, given that we did file for a license. So we'll see how that goes.
It was very good to hear a bit of that background on San Francisco Liberation Radio. I mean, just to point out, I mean, this is a station, a pirate station that's broadcast area included south of Market, Intermission, Castro, Tenderloin, North Beach, Chinatown, and Financial District, and parts of the East Bay, and they managed to seize you for that.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's kind of, you know, in context and...
And broadcasting for a decade.
Right. And
really is, like...
And with such incredible strong ties to the community. Are you guys still on the internet?
We're still online, and, you know, and since then, other pirates have, you know, taken over the frequency, and... Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that's how it should be. You know, if people have something to say, and if, you know, if they feel like, you know, this is necessary. I mean, really, in the Bay Area, there's only, I mean, 93.7 is one of the only channels that's really left to broadcast on. And, you know,
in
a lot of...
In terms of actual on-the-dial,
right,
low wattage FM.
Right, and it's, right. I mean, and it's fast, the pool is vastly shrinking, and especially in urban areas all across the country. I mean, Pete can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Sunny. That was a really great presentation. I think it's a wonderful transition to Pete's remarks, likely, from Prometheus Radio Project.
Great, thanks. So Prometheus Radio Project was founded in 1998. Our origins were in pirate radio, but we found, after running a radio station for about a year and a half and having enormous success with it in that short time, that there was something really missing for us when we did the pirate radio station, because we really wanted, you know, for being on the radio. And there was a few of us that we do a lot of policy work. Radio stations. I'm sorry? Comcast. Yeah. So, strangely enough, after a few years of haggling and kvetching with the FCC, the FCC actually changed its mind about its policy towards community radio. For over 20 years, they had refused to give licenses anywhere in the country to community radio stations. But the pirate radio movement was really very essential in changing the way that the FCC thought about low-power radio. And I think part of it was when it wasn't only the anarchists that were doing it and the militia people, but the, you know, soccer moms and the Kiwanis Club started, you know, starting pirate radio stations. They knew that they had to change their rules around to make it so that all these people were not doing something illegal anymore. And so in 2000, they passed a set of rules. It was really not everything that we wanted, but it was a really good start, and it would allow for many thousands of new community radio stations to start across the country. And they started opening up the windows and giving out permits and everything. And then we actually experienced firsthand what that actual power of the media is in this country, because within a few short months, after we had won at the FCC, Congress came along and they passed a law that took away 3/4 of the frequencies that we would have been eligible for. And the broadcasters made these kind of crazy claims that these little 100-watt radio stations were going to cause a giant, massive interference to these 50,000 and 75,000-watt stations. And strangely enough, Congress believed them, and they told us that, okay, you can go ahead and build these low-power stations in, like, the tiniest little one-horse towns out where nobody's going to hear them. And you're going to have to do a study, and we're going to see whether we can allow any more in some of the urban areas. So for the past 3 years, we've been building a lot of radio stations in places like Opelousas, Louisiana, Immokalee, Florida. I think the biggest city we've worked in is Spokane, Washington. And Spokane, you know, the only place they could get their transmitter was about 7 miles out of town. So they only kind of cover, you know, half of the town in certain neighborhoods.
So do you identify a community partner, or how do you let those communities know about sort of the, you know, the assistance that you offer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, when the service passed, it was sort of like one of those cases of, you know, now the dog has run up and caught the tire of the car, and now what's he going to do with it, you know? So we immediately started, you know, running around the country trying to tell people about this opportunity. And Prometheus has never been involved in content. We've never been involved in, in networks or anything like that. What we just do is we find someone in town. Sometimes we would look at the list of the places where we thought there would be frequencies. Elmira, New York, you know, let's open the phone book and, you know, there's a Planned Parenthood, you know, maybe someone cool is there. And we were just like, you know, we would go to libraries, we, you know, went to, you know, would talk in coffee shops, and we would just find the people that wanted to do radio. And it's really, it's never that difficult once you find that first wingnut in town, because every town has one. They have somebody who always wants to start a radio station, who is a college DJ and has not been able to do it for forever. And once you find that person, then you can kind of, you know, then they put it out there. And we've never had a problem with groups being too small. You know, they always attract 20, 30, 40 people that are very excited, you know, about starting a station. Well, so anyway, we've started building a lot of these stations, and when we do it, we build, a lot of times we just do a lot of advice over the phone and so on, but 3 times a year we do what we call low-power radio barn raising, which is where we get people from all around the region, like about 100, 150 people that want to learn more radio skills. And we bring them all together for a weekend at one of these places that got a license. So the first one we did with an environmental group in Maryland, the South Arundel Citizens for Responsible Development. It was actually the first environmental group in the United States ever to own its own radio station. And we just put the whole station up over the course of the weekend. And meanwhile, we have lots of workshops on how to cut an audio story, how to you know, wire up a transmitter, how to, you know, how to raise an antenna. So We've done five of those, and another one was with the Southern Development Foundation, which was actually the first civil rights organization in the United States that ever owned its own radio station. They are kind of an interesting group because they also host, in addition to working on agricultural reform and school reform and voting rights and everything else, they also host the world's largest Zydeco Festival. And the crazy thing about radio in Opelousas is that it is the world capital of Zydeco music. They have fairs that people come from Japan, all over the place to hear. But if you listen to the radio dial, you will hear a lot of country music and you will hear a lot of classic rock, but you will hear no Zydeco on the radio because all the radio stations are owned by Clear Channel or whoever else. And there's like maybe one show on public radio on Saturday nights at 9 or something like that. But that's it. And so they wanted to start a station that was all about local music. The most recent station that we built was with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is the group that's behind the Taco Bell boycott, an incredibly active farm workers organization from Immokalee, Florida. And that was the first time we did one of these barn-raising events in English and Spanish. And they were just sort of incredible to work with. They called us a few months later, and they told us that, you know, the way that they used to do their organizing, or they still do, the farm worker population turns over about, you know, 30% every year. It's a very, you know, sort of transient population. So they go to all these, trailers that everyone lives in and knock on every door to get at the people in the neighborhood. And there's a very low literacy rate. So mostly they have cartoons that they hand out to sort of explain the role of the coalition. And they typically have meetings of about 30 or 40 people that come out and work on their campaigns with them. That in itself is an incredible number for people that work all day long and under near slavery conditions in many cases. And in actual slavery in some cases, although those are not the ones that manage to get out to the meetings. But after the radio started, suddenly their meeting started to be 100 at reaching people, and the first stints there. And so people were lining up at the payphones, you know, on the streets to request songs or to make statements or whatever. So
it was really cool
to work with them. We hope to go back and do some more with them. But anyway, so that's where Low Power is. We're building in these very small places. Now, we have a great opportunity coming up in the next month or so, which is that the study results actually came back. Remember that study where they figured out, where they're trying to figure out if 100-watt stations interfere with 50,000-watt stations? Well, guess what? They don't. And perhaps the first time this has ever happened, the study was supposed to be in two phases, and they were supposed to, you know, poke these things in this phase and poke those other things in this phase. The contractor that stood to make a fortune off of this study, they already spent $2.2 million on the first phase of the study, came back and they said, this study was so stupid that we don't even want to do the second phase. So now we are going back to Congress with that and saying, well, here's the study that you requested, and this is what the result was. And we've actually found a great ally in John McCain.
Yeah.
And John McCain has his own problem with the broadcasters because they've refused to do free airtime for candidates. And as part of his, like, campaign finance reform thing, trying to stop people from having to raise so much money, he's got a real vengeance against the broadcasters and saw this as a great issue to stick it to them. And Patrick Leahy from Vermont, Maria Cantwell, so they're all introducing legislation in favor of repealing all the stupid laws that were added to Low Power FM in 2000. And just going back and allowing low power radio to come into the major cities. So strangely enough, Michael Powell, also the chairman of the FCC, who we have thought very, very hard on media ownership and other issues, he looked at the results of the study. He said, look, this is ridiculous. I was against low power radio in 2000, but there is no technical reason for this. Let's go ahead. So he's asked Congress to allow low power radio at this point. So we have this really unusual situation. We have a Republican senator, Republican chairman of the FCC, both in favor of low power radio, and it's just great when your opponents are, you know, are on your side on something. So we really want to push this through as fast as we possibly can.
It's amazing, you know, strange bet for low power.